So I'd like to talk for this next part of the Dharma talk on the last of the body contemplations in the Satipatthana Sutta. And these are the what are called the charnel ground contemplations. So when the Buddha was wandering as a mendicant, a seeker, somebody who lived on alms, was living an ascetic life before his awakening, he would spend time practicing in the charnel grounds, just you know, as a place to go and meditate, and these were grounds where people would lay their dead to the open air, to be exposed to the open air, to the animals that would come and devour the corpses and to just the natural work of the sun and the rain and, you know, all the different forces of nature that would decompose the bodies. And this is still done in parts of Tibet. I don't know if it's done at all in India, but mostly I think it's cremation and scattering of ashes to the Ganges, possibly, or other places. But in Tibet, they have the sky burials still, and they bring the body up to the mountaintop, and actually, there are people who crack open the skull, and you know, so that the birds can get to the nutrients of the brain, and so it's considered a giving back to life, giving the body back to life. And so this is the last contemplation that the Buddha gives in this section of the text, and it's really to contemplate death, the inevitability of our own death, and in every spiritual tradition, this is a very key and important teaching. In fact, the Buddha said that this was such an important teaching that there's this story that he was with three of his students, and he asked them each, how often do you contemplate death? You know, how frequently do you contemplate death? And one of them says, Master, I contemplate death on every new moon and every full moon. And the Buddha said, not enough. And then the next one said, Master, I contemplate death every day. And the Buddha said, well, that's better, but it's not enough. And the third one says, Master, I contemplate death with every breath. And he said, yes. So with every breath, that is part of what each in-breath and each out-breath is. It's an arising and it's a passing away. So the contemplation on the charnel grounds goes like this. As though he were to see a corpse. So it's a kind of a visualization. You know, this is not a mindfulness practice. It's a contemplation, it's a visualization. So as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, living, and oozing matter. And one compares this same body with it, one's own body. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. Again, as though one were to see a corpse thrown away in a charnel ground, that is being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or various kinds of worms. And again, it's the same contemplation. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. A corpse thrown away in a charnel ground, which is a skeleton with flesh and blood, held together with sinews. So all of these are further and further states of decomposition. Then he goes on, a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood. A skeleton without flesh and blood. Disconnected bones scattered in the main and immediate directions. Here a hand bone, elsewhere a foot bone, elsewhere a shin bone, elsewhere a thigh bone, elsewhere a hip bone, a backbone, and elsewhere a skull. So the sinews have decomposed, so they're not holding the body together as a recognizable human body, and the bones are just scattering. Then the bones bleached white, the color of shells. Then bones heaped up more than a year old, so they've been moved around by animals, blown around perhaps. Bones rotten and crumbling to dust. So eventually the bones, which, are the strongest part of the body, the most, these minerals that exist in the bones, even these begin to fall apart. Bones rotten and crumbling to dust. One compares the same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. In this way, in regard to the body, he imbibes contemplating the body internally and externally, and both internally and externally. He abides contemplating the nature of arising, of passing away, of both arising and passing away in the body. And mindfulness that there is a body is established in one to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how, in regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body. So this is not to, be depressing. The purpose of this is to free us. To free us from the fear and from the clinging and from the identification that this body is me or mine. So we've been reflecting on the body with the contemplations, the parts of the body, the selfless nature of the body, and now recognizing that the body not only intellectually understanding that we will die, I think we all get that, but really taking it in, making a practice of taking in and what are the implications of this truth, of living in the light of this truth for us. From the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, unlike those who don't realize that we're here on the verge of perishing. We don't know when we'll die at any moment. those who do realize that, their quarrels are stilled. So that's an effect of contemplating our death. Those little conflicts or big conflicts or disagreements or dislikes that seem so important, can we let them go? can we live in peace? It's not to say that, you know, we don't need to take care of ourselves if we're in a relationship or there is a relationship in our lives which is harming us. But to be at peace with what our decision is about how we work with that. In our society, in our culture, we have a lot of avoidance of death. We hide it away. We put people, when somebody's died, they usually go to a morgue and then they're made to look as if they're alive, faces painted. I mean, I think that there's a changing attitude about that because environmentally, the chemicals that are pumped into corpses to make them look lifelike are so destructive. So I think there's a changing cultural attitude toward what we do with bodies, but we certainly want them, taken out of our sight. And out of sight, out of mind. We don't want to think about it. We want to keep thinking that death is some distant future thing that, will. Yeah, okay, I know. Maybe when I'm 90, maybe 100. we're living longer and longer these days, right? I know somebody who lived 103. So this is how our mind thinks. And then somebody we know dies and maybe they were 30 or 40 or 50. That's tragic, it's tragic. But, one of these days, walk in the cemetery, which is behind the park, when you go out of the out of Galilee Center, and there's a park there. And just if you walk through the park, there's an old cemetery, one of these old cemeteries that has headstones dating back to early 19th century. And we'll see. You see, so many. Of course, we have better averages on infant mortality, but so many babies and young children, and then so many young people at the time of the Great War, and then so many people dying in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and we are on average living longer, and there are also still many people who die early for all kinds of reasons. Accidents, diseases. All living beings want to live. All living beings want to live and to not die. We just see it. We see it with a spider. I come into the bathroom and, I open the door and the spider senses movement and freezes. And I think, be at peace. You're okay. But the thing about human beings and maybe other highly evolved mammals is that, we have an understanding that we will die. So how do we work with that? How do we work with that understanding? A lot of us avoid it as I said, not thinking about it, assuming I'm going to live a long life. Some of us also create strong beliefs about death. And, you know, whatever it is, I'm going to go to heaven, I'm going to see all my family, I'm going to be reborn, you know, as you know, all of these things are avoiding the not knowing around what is death. Death was a very important part of the Buddha's spiritual path. Many of you are probably familiar with the story of the Buddha's embarking on his spiritual journey. He lived a very privileged life as a prince, and his father had wanted to protect him from any signs of the unsatisfactoriness of mundane life, that things do age and things do die and things do fall apart. And so, because there had been this prophecy that the Buddha would either be a great king or a great spiritual teacher. And so the Buddha's father understood that if he saw through the incapacity of our world, our conditioned world, to give us a fulfilling sense of peace and contentment in our lives, that he would seek wisdom, and so, which was transcendent, and so the Buddha, as a young man, ventured out beyond the palace grounds because he had a curious and interested mind. And he went with his coachman, who was also a dear friend. And so he went out several times. The first time he saw somebody who was old. And this is a teaching story, so you don't have to take it absolutely, you know, that it's literally true. It's a teaching story. So, and I think it's a good one for our times because of the way that we try to disguise aging and illness and death. You know, we think that we've done something wrong if we get sick. And so the Buddha had gone out. He had seen somebody who was old and had talked to his friend about this and said, you know, what is it with this person? You know, why do they look like that? Well, sir, he's an old person. And somebody was sick. What's wrong with her? You know, why is she coughing? And, you know, and so it's a sick person. So then the third time he goes out and each time he comes back, you know, to his palace, and he's really reflecting on these things. It's disturbing. It says again, he grew restless and ill at ease, and he wanted to know more of the fate of those who live in this world. And he summoned his chariot and once more set forth. Now, this is a telling, kind of a rendering of the story by Douglas Pennick. And I found it in Tricycle magazine. I really liked it. And this time he saw a procession of men and women weeping. And on their shoulders they carried a stretcher. And it was the form of a woman wrapped in cotton, shrunken, brittle, motionless. Her face was gray, her mouth open, but she did not breathe. Flies crawled in and out of her nose, but she did not react. She was rigid and lifeless as a stick of dried wood. Those carrying her and all of those in the procession were weeping and crying. And the prince asked, you know, what is that thing in the shape of a deformed woman? It's rigid and immobile and must be carried. It's followed by a crowd wailing and wearing white clothes. What is this? What's happening here? What is she doing? And the charioteer replied, My Lord, she has neither intelligence nor feeling nor breath. She sleeps without consciousness. She is insensitive to pleasure or suffering. Sire, she is dead. And the prince said, is this woman the only one stricken in this way? And the charioteer answered, no, this is the end that awaits every living being. And the prince said, and where has life gone? Where has consciousness gone? And his friend said, no one knows, my lord. But certainly many religions and many philosophies have taught that a soul or consciousness has an afterlife. Siddhartha asked, is this true? All we know are visions and words from living men and women. The dead do not speak. So we know we will die, but we do not know anything beyond that. Death, my Lord, is the end of our understanding. And then Siddhartha said, we cannot stop it. Our minds teem with theories. We struggle and we kill to take control of destiny. We fill the world with dreams. No matter, we will die. No matter, we do not know when or why or for what purpose. So this had a profound impact. And then the next time Siddhartha left the palace, he saw walking in the distance a wandering sramana, which is like a spiritual seeker. And he said, this is what I will do. I will go out and I will try to find a way that is beyond aging, illness, and death. And the Buddha, when the Buddha, you know, he went through many practices and austerities and tried to find, what was the way beyond death. And under the Bodhi tree, under the Bodhi tree, as he awakened, he said, I have realized the deathless. So there is this capacity that we have to wake up from this delusion that this body is me, is mine, and to realize, and the Buddha usually used negatives to describe it. He referred to this as the deathless. He referred to this awakening as the unborn, the unconditioned, and he called it nibbana, or nirvana, which in Sanskrit, which is a word that that means the extinguishment of suffering, the extinguishment of craving, the extinguishment of clinging. And he didn't say what it is. He didn't say it is anything. And at the same time, he said, if you could not realize this, then I would not be teaching you. So there is an awakening, there is a realization of anytime you start to use a word, the thing about words is that words break up reality into pieces so that we can talk about it and put it together in different ways. But words don't serve to bring us to an experience which is beyond the understanding of our conceptual minds. So many teachers, the Buddha, Ajahn Chah, I think Muhammad said this too in different ways. Teachers tell us to die before we die. So die to the clinging. What does it mean to die to the clinging? It means to let go, let it go. See through the futility of it. See the uselessness of it. See the suffering of it, and live in freedom. It doesn't mean that we don't live with caring. And I think there's that, you know, that middle way that we need to find again and again. So if we recognize that we die, does it mean that we don't care about life? So it's that heart which is deeply connected to all, and at the same time, you know, recognizes that there is nothing that we can claim that we are. Nisargadatta, a great 20th century master, put it this way: wisdom tells me I'm nothing, and love tells me I'm everything. And between these two, my life flows. So, in contemplating death, you know, we're opening to that difficult truth that there's nothing we can hold on to. There's a I think I'm just going to end with this poem, which I think is quite apt at this time of year, as we look out at the trees that have lost their leaves. It's called "Learning from Trees," and the poet is Grace Butcher. If we could, like the trees, practice dying. Do it every year, just as something we do, like going on vacation or celebrating birthdays. It would become as easy a part of us as our hair or clothing. Someone would show us how to lie down and fade away as if in deepest meditation, and we would learn about the fine, dark emptiness, both knowing it and not knowing it. And coming back would be irrelevant. Whatever it is the trees know when they stand undone, surprisingly intricate, we need to know also, so we can allow that last thing to happen to us as if it were only any ordinary thing. Leaves and lives falling away, the spirit complex, waiting in the fine darkness to learn which way it will go. So let's sit for a minute. So we have